Okay, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Allison from the Lansdale Beginners Group.
Hi, I'm Allison Adams. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for inviting me, Dave. I have met some awesome people that are part of this group. I want to thank my friend Veronica for introducing me to you guys after I moved here 3 years ago. I love AA, and I love talking about AA, so I'm glad I'm up here tonight. I hope y'all find it possible to stay awake. So I got sober on September 26th of 1992 in Los Angeles, California. And I'm so grateful that my life is not the way it was when I met you guys. I'm so glad that there was AA here for me when I needed you so desperately. And to this very day, I actually grew up outside of Houston, Texas, and I used to think that was my problem. I grew up in this little rice farm in town named Alvin, and I have these two sisters and this brother. We fought incessantly as youth. My siblings were my problem. The fact that my parents didn't love me enough was my problem. The fact that I didn't think that I fit in was the problem. I as far back as I can remember, I have always felt different than you. And I used to say that I think I was born alcoholic, and I guess that's true, but my sponsor said, you know, you can't know if you're alcoholic till you take a drink and know if you have the allergy or not. So suffice it to say, as Bill Wilson says in the literature, we were more or less neurotic. Well, I was definitely born neurotic, I can say that. I have always been acutely aware of myself and the world and how I fit into the world around me, and it's always been rather unpleasant. I have always felt like there was a high-grade sandpaper between you and me. I have always felt different from you. I have always felt separate. I have always felt like I don't fit in. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me tools to not have to feel that way anymore. When I was little, I tried to find ways to equalize the fact that I felt so different on the inside by changing my outsides. And one of my brilliant ideas was that I tried to break my arm by jumping off the monkey bars at my house so that I could get a cast and that you could sign my cast at school and tell me how great I was. And so desperate for your approval always. And I was too chicken to actually make that happen. And so I thought that if I sat by the palm plant in my front yard and stared at the sun and went blind, then I would be special and you'd feel sorry for me. And that was good enough for me to try to match that difference. I also thought that because my name was Allison and not something like Mary, that maybe that was why I felt like I didn't fit in. And these were thoughts going on when I was much younger. I got involved in sports when I was young. I was pretty good at sports. That was one way that I thought that I could feel better than you. And I don't know if any of you identify with great arrogance and major insecurity, but that dominated my life for many years and sometimes still does. But I was very active in running and doing summer sports, and I was pretty good at it, and I loved the way that that made me feel. And I got into reading a lot because it took me away from the reality of being with you. Because I don't know how you do what you do, but clearly you know something I don't. And thank God, at the age of 15, I found alcohol. Thank God there was something that was going to provide a solution in my life until I could find a power greater than myself through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got drunk on May 29th of 1980. I was 15 years old. It was at the end of my freshman year in high school in Alvin, Texas, when my best friend threw a party. And she had invited the freshman class over. I went to that party. I knew that I wanted to get drunk that night. I had not experienced drunkenness before, but I have an older sister who has dabbled in AA before, and she liked to party. And I knew that when my sister drank, boys knew my sister's name. And I didn't quite know how she acquired that reputation, but I knew that my sister was popular, and I wanted to be popular. So at that party on May 29th of 1980, I asked some older kids. The drinking age was 19 in Texas at that time. I asked some kids to buy me a bottle of Tickle Pink, and they ended up coming back with a bottle of Strawberry Hill. That's okay. I was fine with that. I hung out behind a bush near the front door of my friend's house, and I drank that bottle of Strawberry Hill. I later found a six-pack of beer and drank a couple of those. Never acquired a taste for beer, but it'll do when nothing else is around. And I experienced the power of alcohol. What alcohol did for me that night is it provided a power in my life that I didn't know I was lacking. It filled every hole that was in my soul at that time in my life. I feel like I fit in. I felt like I was a part of. I danced in front of other people. I thought I was pretty. I got a hickey on my neck. This is pretty much what happened for the next 12 years, actually. And I loved the way I felt when I drank. I don't think my feet touched the ground. I felt empowered, and I loved that feeling. And that feeling that I had that night is the exact feeling, the same experience I sought every time I drank until I found you guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so in September of 1992, 12 years later, when I finally found you and I told you that it wasn't working for me anymore, what I mean is that alcohol no longer made me feel empowered when I drank it. Sometimes it might work a little bit. A lot of times it didn't. Sometimes it took more. I just didn't count on my old best friend to do the job anymore. So I started my drinking career in Alvin, Texas in 1980. I moved to Los Angeles in 1983 when I graduated high school. I had gotten involved with some people that were much like myself in Texas before I left there. There's not much surfing on the coast of Texas, but I used to hang out in Galveston with some people who like to surf. And we would hang out and sleep overnight in the van and sleep on the beach and drink and do other things. And, you know, I started this lifestyle of skipping classes and just, you know, nothing else mattered in my life except for how alcohol made me feel. And that was the life that I pursued. So I wanted to be around the people who did what I did. And those are the people I hung out with. I moved to California in 1983. I was 18 years old. I was set up to go to the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising outside of downtown L.A. I lived right near MacArthur Park, which was a rather nice park during the day. I was an ethnic minority there. I didn't speak the language in that neighborhood. I found it very easy to buy booze in California when I was 18 years old because no one spoke the same language I did where I was living at that time. And even though the drinking age was 21, I had a roommate from Bellevue, Washington, and she got the most amazing stuff shipped to her from Washington that I had never experienced before, that she was growing up there. And but I liked drinking, and I was drinking a lot of vodka at that time, and she was getting this stuff that I had not really it was awesome. And I drank. I dropped out of school shortly after I got to California. I discovered that the buses would go up to Hollywood, and I started hanging out in Hollywood. I discovered something else at the age of 14 and 15, and that was the power of rock and roll in my life. I absolutely love heavy metal music to this very day. But now I kind of look like a dork when I bang my head because I'm a mother of two and I drive kind of a boring car. But Pantera any day as far as I'm concerned. So I'm out in California accomplishing nothing in my life. I'm going to bars in Hollywood. I always thought that if you could just see me on the cover of Teen Beat magazine on the arm of some rock and roll guitar player, that I'd have my life made. I mean, I wasn't pursuing goals for a living and tools for living in my life. I was just looking for a good time. I failed to grow up. I was immature, selfish, and self-centered. I started fooling around with everybody, pretty much. I was looking for someone to take care of me. I was terrified of the world, and I was always looking for a stronger personality than mine to take. I was scared. I used bravado. I got a very sharp tongue. I was very foul mouthed. I tried to bluster my way to try to keep myself safe and keep you away to a certain degree. But at the same time, I was always looking for some guy to try to take care of me. And I didn't do a very good job at that. I tended to attract people that were attracted to people like me, which didn't give them much cred, you know. but I found people that liked to party like I liked to party. And you know, things weren't going well. After being in L.A. for 2 years, I was hanging out. I had a sugar daddy up in Hollywood that was giving me all kinds of things. And I knew inherently that something was wrong. I knew it wasn't my drinking. But I knew that there was a level of control I was losing in my life, and I went back to Texas for a little while. My mother did not want me in her house because of my behavior and my attitude. I moved up to Houston on Westheimer Road and lived down the street from the local rock club, and I was housing all the bands that would come and play through that club during the week that were traveling the East Coast and in the Midwest. And I had a great time, and I loved my life. I loved feeling like I was better than you. I really did, because I was so insecure, and I knew that there was something wrong with me. And if there was something I could brag about, some name I could drop, something that made me feel like I was better than you, I was going to make sure you knew about it. And I don't know, I'm sure nobody identifies with that. But, you know, I went in high school, I was a cheerleader. because I wanted to wear a T-shirt that said I was a cheerleader and had my name on the back, so you know I was better than you. And then once I knew that you knew that, then we both knew that you knew I was better than you, right? And I felt horrible about myself. And I didn't hesitate to do whatever I had to do to survive being with you. And that meant drinking a lot. That meant putting on airs, being really arrogant, self-centered, selfish. I didn't care who I hurt around me because, frankly, the hole in my soul and the pain in my gut was so great that it was a full-time job for me to take care of it. So if you were harmed by my behavior, I am really sorry, but you must be really too sensitive. And I'm just going to keep doing what I have to do, and maybe you should just stay out of my way. I didn't find it necessary to make friends with women at this point in my life. What good are you? Quite frankly, you're my competition. And I sought the attention of men all the time. I really never thought that maybe a college education might be a good idea, get a job, be self-supporting. Mm-mm. And I went back to California in 1987. I got a job bartending. I worked on the Santa Monica Pier for 7 years. And that's where the brunt of my insanity happened. I worked on the Santa Monica Pier, tending bar. I got into management with that company. I was going to bars in Hollywood. I was assaulted up there one night. This little hairdresser dude tried to attack me. God, he pissed me off because I was bigger than he was. And he was a hairdresser. No offense if we're... But I was bigger than he was. And I found myself at the corner of Sunset Boulevard and Doheny, next to the Roxy, with no shirt on and no way to get home, 15 miles to Santa Monica. And a cab had pity on me and gave me a ride home. And like the good daughter that I was, I called my mother 1,800 miles away in Texas and woke her up at 3 a.m. and blamed her for the situation I was in. I still can't make sense of that one, but I was unwilling to take responsibility for my life. If something is wrong with my life, it is always someone else's fault. And parents are always at the top of the list. Because I could always find someone to tell me that was probably true. But I drank to smooth out the rough edges of my thinking. I drank to make me feel like I was going to be okay, that there was actually going to be some hope in my life. I knew that there was something wrong with me. I moved in with some guys down on the west side near the Santa Monica Pier. They were good friends. They took care of me. They let me live with them. I didn't make much money working down there because I tend to spend it all drinking. And they let me live with them as long as I cleaned their house. And we partied together, and we had a great time. And I was quickly going nowhere. And then in the early 1990s, my younger sister had moved out to California. She had married a gentleman that she worked with. And she was my younger sister's a lot like me. I got two sisters, and my younger sister's a lot like me. God bless her. And she and I, you know, my younger sister was more petite than me. A little more chesty than me, and longer hair than me, and got a better face than I do. And she used to get, she like, my sister could get the singer in the band. I used to have to get the bass player. So, now, no offense, but this was my thinking. And so I knew that in order to get the singer, normally you had to be the stripper, and I wasn't a stripper because I was too insecure. And so, but my sister could catch one. And so we would go to bars, and I'd hang out with my sister, and I would always just kind of hang out hoping that they would bring someone that would tolerate me. And so my sister and I were a bit of a force to be reckoned with at the clubs in Hollywood, and this was my life. And drinking, hoping that there would be no consequences. I had hangovers. I often woke up in the San Fernando Valley with some road crew member, not knowing how the hell I got there. And I know, road crew. And, you know, and San Fernando Valley is laid out in squares, but I could never find my way out of that damn place. And my life, quickly going nowhere, thinking not much of myself. And in 1991, the Santa Monica Pier closed. They were remodeling the pier. They have since put an amusement park back down there that had gotten destroyed back in the early 80s. I was without a job temporarily. I had a roommate at that time. She was dating a friend of mine, and she lived very well. And I said, you know, do you think I can get a job with you? Because I'd really like to make good money like you make. And she said, let me see if I can get you an interview. So I have since moved on to Jack Daniels at this time, you guys. God, I love Jack, Gentleman Jack. Gentleman Jack drinkers out there. I love Gentleman Jack. I know, nice and smooth. Gentleman Jack, 2 ounce shot with a Jack and Coke back. Yeah. And so I was drinking a lot of Jack, and I said, can I get a job with you? She said, let me see if I can get you an interview. So I found myself, I got the job, working at the Hollywood Tropicana female mud wrestling bar. And, but see, I was too insecure to put on a bikini and table dance and mud wrestle you in foam and mud, but I was a cocktail waitress, and So I was a cocktail waitress spending all my money, all my tips on drinking tequila as well, and quickly going nowhere. And she was making all the money. And, you know, I just, my life was really, really dark. And at this time in my life, my father had fallen ill. My father and mother split when I was 17 years old. He married somebody else. I held a resentment against my dad for many years because he had married somebody else and left us. But he got married, and my father got ill, and he had this illness called Lou Gehrig's disease. And I found it very, very hard to be of service to my father because I didn't know how to deal with his illness. I didn't know how to be of service to him. I was embarrassed by the fact that he started to lose the ability to walk. He lost the ability to feed himself. He started to lose the ability to talk very well. And I was embarrassed by the way he looked. And I didn't know how to act towards him, and I resented him for asking me to visit him because I didn't know what to do for him. And I was full of self and frightened, but I turned it into anger and aloofness, and I would often avoid him at all costs, actually. So this is the kind of person that came to you many months later. In the fall of 1992, after having been at that job for several months, the old Hollywood Tropicana, and spending all my money on drinking, my father passed away. My father died on Valentine's Day of 1992. He had been sick, I think, for 4 years. I had cashed in some plane tickets he had bought me to come see him 4 weeks before because I didn't want to have to go see him because I didn't know how to be of service to him. I lied to him and told him I couldn't leave, and I cashed that money and used it to drink. And when I got the call that day, it took me till noon before I could come out of my stupor to answer the phone call and find out what had happened. But now I had a really good reason for you to buy me something to drink, right? And I used that as much as I could. I continued to work through that summer and tell my story of woe to anybody who would I could manipulate to buy me something to drink. And on the Santa Monica Pier in the summertime, they had these free concert series down there. They had some bigger name acts, and they give free concerts on the pier, which makes a ton of money for us bartenders working down there. I always had a great time. And at the end of the summer in 1992, I found myself, I was going to go out to Palm Springs to work on my tan because it's really important how you look, isn't it, ladies? And at the end of the summer, I was going to spend 3 days in Palm Springs with my younger sister. We were going to go out there and drink and work on our tans, laying by the pool. But we never really made it there in September. We had gone up to one of the clubs in Hollywood, and my sister had met this kid from a Skid Row video. Remember that band? That 18 in Life video, that kid. And he was one of us, I think. We're drinking with him and running around Hollywood doing things we shouldn't have been doing and passing out in different places and continuing to drink for 3 days. And we never got to work on our tans in Palm Springs. But what we did is I found myself on September 24th of 1992 in my sister's apartment, one block away from where I lived. And I was out of my mind with fear. Fear. My sister came and woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning because I knew I had to go back to work the next day to work a split shift. And she said, there's these guys outside. I had used some guys to get what I wanted. I didn't pay them what they were supposed to be paid, and I know they're coming to kill us. I just saw them out the window, and we looked out the window, and we know that we saw them down there. We thought they were going to rip off a boat down there and maybe come and get us, and we called the police, and the police showed up, and the police didn't see a thing, by golly. And the police left, and I knew when those police left that I was going to die, and I didn't know how I was going to die, but I was so full of fear for my own safety, for my own sanity, that I fell on the floor and I just cried. And I called one of my friends. I used to run around with some bikers on the west side, and I called one of those guys up. I said, you need to come and get me because I need a ride home. I'm not staying at my sister's place. We might die here tonight. No grandiosity whatsoever. And this guy came and got me on his bike, and I looked at my sister. I said, there's only room for one. I'll check and see if you're alive in the morning. And I lived a block away. I lived a block away. And I got home about 4 a.m., and I came to about 10:30 the next morning, absolutely faced with the truth about myself, the way that I understand it. My moment of clarity is what I believe. And what I saw that morning in my soul and in my heart was that, and I've heard it from this podium so many times, is that I knew that at that moment that there was absolutely nothing I could do that day to not take another drink of alcohol, that left to my own devices, there was no way I was going to get through that day and go to bed that night without taking a drink unless I got some help. And the other thing I was absolutely 100% sure of is I was absolutely incapable of changing my life. There was nothing I could do to do anything different than the way I was doing it. I had no power to live any differently than the way I was living it right at that moment. And I knew without somebody coming to help me, that that was going to be what my life was going to be like. And that fact about myself was untenable. And with that fear, I called someone I knew in AA. And the reason I knew someone in AA was, by golly, I was a bartender. And I used to drink with this girl. You know, there's a story in, I think it's Language of the Heart, called Emotional Sobriety, the Next Frontier. And Bill Wilson refers to it as a faulty emotional dependency, and that was what this girl was to me. She is someone who I sought out. My association with her gave me feelings of self-satisfaction and approval because she had been a very successful model over in Europe. She was from London. She was well-educated. She was socially adept. She had married quite well and lived in a penthouse down in Santa Monica. She was beautiful and graceful, and I wanted what she had. Most of it was money, property, and prestige. But what she also had was sobriety. She was sober 3 years. And when she had gone to AA, it was at that time that I really couldn't be her best friend anymore. Now, could I? Those people took her away from me. And she had extended the hand of AA to me always by telling me, you know, I go to these really great meetings and these people are nuts. You're going to hear the funniest stories. You should come to a meeting with me sometime. And, of course, I promised her that I would, because I will do anything for you if you will please just like me. But when it comes to following through, I'm not so good at that. You know, and what my sponsor said, I was a 50-yard man in a 100-yard race. And that's the story of my life. And but I called her that morning, and she answered the phone. And she said, I'm going to come see you at work. Can I meet you at your lunchtime? And I said, yes. And she showed up. And there she was, a beautiful example of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tall and statuesque and beautiful as she normally is, but much more graceful than I had ever remembered her. And the whites of her eyes were as clear as I had ever seen them, and she was just a sight to behold, in my opinion. And she sat down with me, and she talked about what it was like for her to be sober. And she suggested that maybe I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through the blessing of my own desperation, I was willing to take that direction. And I found myself at a meeting on Friday night, September 25th, in 1992, on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, at a speaker meeting at the corner of Santa Monica Boulevard and Rodeo Drive. Now, I didn't think that Beverly Hills, if they ever saw me in their city limits, they'd ever let me in. But nobody told me I had to leave when I got to that Romanesque church. In fact, I walked into this beautiful courtyard, and inside that courtyard there was groups of twos and threes, and they were talking to one another, much like I saw people out here when I came in tonight. And there was something really frightening about some of those people, because you see there were some guys there, and one in particular that turned around and said hello to me, and he wore like this khaki jacket with brown leather patches on the elbows, and he was wearing these pleated khaki pants. They had a crease right down the front. And, you know, looking kind of like Ed tonight, without jacket. Looking clean cut and gentlemanly. And I knew I wasn't good enough to be around guys like that. But he was nice to me, and he said, hi, welcome to AA. How long are you sober? I said, it's my first day. He goes, I'm really glad you're here. Welcome. And I knew at that very moment he wanted me. Just thinking about myself. And I haven't had to take a drink since that meeting. But what I found after that meeting, I did an inventory 3 months, my first inventory 3 months later, all one page of it. And what I realized is that after I went to that meeting on my way home, I got a bottle of cough medicine or something to help me fall asleep that night. I think I drank a bottle of Robitussin or something. And I realized later that I couldn't count that day as my sobriety because I had taken something that altered my mind for the use of trying to go to sleep. And so I changed my sobriety date to the 26th. And today I celebrate the 26th as my sobriety date. And I instantly grew affection for Alcoholics Anonymous. I started my meetings in Hollywood, California, because, you see, they have, like, musician meetings there. And I realized that there was, like, this whole society of men that hadn't met me yet. That's how I saw it, you know. And yeah, only now, you know, only in recent years could I actually admit all this. And but, you know, and it was, and I had always heard it's not what brings you here and keeps you here. It's the fact that you come, you know, motives don't matter in the beginning. And it certainly counted when it came to staying sober, but not in the beginning. I was here to look for a date. I was here for you to check it all out. You know, I just was here, and I was so excited that I wasn't drinking, and I didn't know why I wasn't drinking. I didn't understand about a power greater myself. I mean, I had grown up and gone to church, but God hated me. He hated me. But I knew that for some reason, one day I drank and the next day I didn't. I didn't know what that was all about. And so, You know, I started going to meetings in Hollywood, and then about 6 months of sobriety, I got some money from my father's estate once his estate settled, and I got myself a car, and I got myself an apartment down in Venice Beach, because now that I was sober, I had to find a way to stay cool, and I knew if I was going to stay cool, I needed to be by Venice Beach, right? So I got my little one-room apartment down there. I promptly put photos of myself all over the walls, and I started going to meetings on the west side because, you see, Hollywood was like 7 miles, you guys. Whew, that's willing to go to any lengths, right? I was not going to drive 7 miles to go to a meeting if I didn't have to, so I just started staying by the beach. They had a Saturday morning meeting on the beach and a Sunday morning meeting on the beach where I promptly wore my almost nothing bikini on the beach for those meetings and just desperate for attention, And I was going to meetings not here to work the steps. I was looking for social life, you know. And at 2.5 years of coming to meetings, not working the 12 steps, I had had a sponsor that I would call only when the pucky hit the fan and I was crying. And it was always about the fact that my father had died. That was the only thing I could give her behind my pain. And at 2.5 years of that kind of behavior, I found myself in a new meeting in Santa Monica, listening to a guy at the podium talking about his experience with step 7. And I realized at that moment I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. I hadn't worked the 12 steps. I had just been going to meetings and trying to look cute. You know, I'm the girl that comes in late, sits on the side. I wear what I'm going to wear to the gym because I don't want to waste any time, so it's all made of spandex. And I've got the wife beater tied in a knot in the back over the top of it. I got piercings all down the front so you can see them through my shirt. And I'm sitting over here in the front row, but then I get up and walk around during the meeting so the guys can look at it. And I am what my sponsor later, because he used to watch me. He's like, "You're a typhoid Mary. You're bringing the disease of alcoholism in here." And I met this man. He had 16 years of sobriety. He was going to that meeting, and he'd look at me, and he'd go like this. But that man had something that I wanted, and it was what I realized. It was a God in his life that was working for him. It was a recovery through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I knew that there was this aura about him. I knew that when he came into a meeting, people wanted to talk to him. He had a lot more time than most of the people at that meeting, and I used to think, well, maybe it's just because he's got 16 years. But he always got asked to share. He was always a bit self-deprecating, and he made fun of us alcoholics, and people laughed. And there was something he had, and I asked him to have coffee with me because I was in so much pain. I was a dry drunk. Once again, the level of my emotional desperation as a result of my inaction in Alcoholics Anonymous drove me to ask someone else for help as opposed to living on my own self-will. And I asked that man to have coffee with me, and we had coffee, and they had these clear coffee mugs, and he said, "Can you see through my black coffee, the bottom half of this mug?" And I said, "No." He goes, "You know, that's your sobriety." And I'm like, "Well, that makes no sense." And he said, he goes, "You know, on page 55 of the big book, it says that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, though we may be obscured by pomp, by calamity, and by the worship of other things." And it was at that moment that I was terrified that this man could read my mind, but I was also relieved that there was someone who understood me, that he absolutely knew what was up with me. And I wanted what he had, but I didn't ask him to sponsor me because I had these 2 Pantera tickets and typo negative tickets in my pocket. I was not going to miss that show, and I didn't. And in the 2 weeks, I went to that show, and a week after that, I got busted at the bar I was working at over by UCLA because I got caught serving a minor by some undercover police. And this man I had met in AA was the only one I knew to call that would take my phone call, and I called him desperately. I had just gotten fired. I was humiliated. And he said, "Well, that's too bad. You know, I'm speaking out at a conference this weekend out in Palm Springs. Why don't you come out there? I sponsor a bunch of women and men. They'll be there. You can stay with the women I sponsor and come and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Did you hear me? I don't have any money." And he hung up on me. And how dare he? And I called him back and I said, "Who do I need to talk to?" And I had this Jack Daniels jar. I had about $50 worth of quarters in it. And I found myself in my little Toyota white truck, putting it out, you know, 90 miles to Palm Springs. And I ran into the women he sponsored, and I thought, "Oh, those are the women he sponsors. Those are those women I hate. Because they're the ones who take greeting commitments at the front door. They stick with the women. They dress like ladies and act like ladies." Mm-hmm. I hate those women. They were the kind of women that I'm not good enough to be around. I was terrified. I was terrified to be around them because they were going to know my number. But they let me stay with them. I got to sleep on the floor. And at the end of that weekend, I was hanging back at the taper's table. And I didn't want to go hear the Sunday morning speaker because I wanted to show off my body jewelry on the front of my, wearing a mid-drip. I was belly dancing to sell speaker tapes, being a service. And the taper said, you know, why don't you go in and listen? There was a guy speaking that weekend named Earl Hightower. And you got a pretty powerful talk on a Sunday morning. He goes, why? Here's a couple dollars. Go get yourself a raffle ticket and go listen to Earl give his talk. And I said, great, okay, I'll do that. You give me some money. So I went in and bought those raffle tickets and heard this great talk. And it was great. And I ended up winning that raffle. And I won $100. And as little as $100 can be in anybody's life at any given time, at that moment, it told me that there was a God that was willing to look out for me, you guys. I didn't know how I was going to get money to get through the week. I didn't know how I was going to buy food for the next week. And that $100 was everything that I needed. And I knew at that moment that there was something greater than myself that was indicating that there might be some hope for someone like me. And then I asked that guy to sponsor me, and he sponsored me for almost 5 years. My life changed. He said, I don't care if you like me, and I don't care if you like what I have to say. Are you willing to do it as long as it's not illegal, indecent, or immoral? And I said, yes. He goes, I want you to take your head and put it on a rack and just do as I ask you to do without debate for the next couple of years. You're not going to see any changes in yourself. Other people will see it in you first. So you need to give it about 6 months. He goes, I want you to get to a job where you can work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. I want you to be available to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at night where you can see the real enthusiasm for what we do here. I want you to be available to go to AA on the weekends because we travel all over, because you need to know that AA works everywhere. He goes, I need you to stop dressing like a hooker and start acting like a lady. You can go to Salvation Army if that's what it takes. You need to find something else to wear. And stop talking like a truck driver. You're not a tough girl after all. He goes, you need to start showing some respect to this one thing that might just save your life. I hated him. He must have known that was going to happen. But this man represented something. I know that men don't generally sponsor women, but he talked louder than my head. My head has a lot of power in my life, you guys. I am absolutely dominated by my feelings, and this man had a way of being able to talk over that. So I was able to do what I needed to do. I moved in with those women I couldn't stand. They helped me move in with them. I had to have a commitment in the apartment we lived in to help clean up. I got a little job at a copy print shop making $6.50 an hour. And I knew I was better than everybody there until I got there and I realized I was absolutely incapable of doing the job. Because I had to give good customer service without being drunk or wearing tight shorts. And I worked at that company for 5 years and I moved into management with them. And what I learned was that I became a worker among workers. I had to learn to give 8 hours work for 8 hours pay. I had to show up and be there on time. I had to take a 30-minute lunch break because that's what they gave me. And that job was willing to let me leave work 15 minutes early on Wednesday so I could get dressed and go to my home group. My home group in Los Angeles became the Pacific Group of AA. There was 850 regular members on a Wednesday night in Brentwood, California. And I was terrified there. It took a while getting used to that. But I dressed up for my home group. I was told when I was at my home group, I was to dress nicely and be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was suggested that I stick with the women and try to get to know the women in AA, that one day I might actually have a message to share with one of them. And my sponsor used to tell me to keep my mouth shut because I probably didn't know what I was talking about anyways. Be a good idea to listen for a while. And then he suggested, he goes, I don't know what kind of God you're living by in your life, but it's clearly it's not working for you. Why don't you drop the one you have? And if you think he's working in my life, you can borrow mine until you find your own. And I realized he was right. And I fell into line, and I was a good little foot soldier in AA. I came to love Alcoholics Anonymous. AA became my way of life. It's not what I did 1 hour, 3 days a week. It became the priority in my life. It's what I did in the morning. I had to get up and do a 10th and 11th step every morning. At the end of my day, I had to do a 10th and 11th step at night if it was warranted. Always the 11th step. I had to call my sponsor at 6:40 a.m. every morning, Monday through Friday. I had a 5 minutes chance to talk to him on the phone. And if I needed more time, then I had to schedule time aside from that with him. I went to 6 meetings a week, and on one night a week, I got a night off, which meant that I could go to a meeting with just my AA sisters. And we'd usually go to dinner down in Santa Monica or up in Century City and then go to a movie and then a meeting and stuff like that. But I came to love AA, and I came to find the value of relationships with women Alcoholics Anonymous, because those are the people who shared the kind of thoughts that I had, the kind of manipulations, the kind of dishonesty. We were able to share our vulgar humor amongst ourselves without having to share it on a public level or with members of the opposite sex. I had to be taught how to start acting a more appropriate around men, unless I started wanting to attract the kind of men I had been attracting. And my sponsor said I'd never find a husband unless I started acting like the kind of man that a man would want to take home to his wife, his mother, excuse me. My husband will never hear this. Anyway, so, So I got active in AA and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was probably 5 years sober before I realized I actually liked you guys. Before I realized that I loved AA, I kept thinking that all of the time I spent in AA, I kept thinking that it was going to keep me from doing what I wanted to do out there. And the fact is you are what gave me my life. You are what breathed life into my soul. I got busy doing the 12 steps. I got busy trying to practice traditions not only in AA but in my life. I got involved in general service and speaking around and taking commitments. And I had to be at all my meetings at least a half an hour early and take a little job in the meeting. And I learned to, my life became a bout of AA, and I learned to find a power greater than myself, I thought. I left that sponsorship in 1999. Right before that had happened, I had met my husband, now husband. He was a member of my home group. I couldn't stand him. I went to a meeting with a friend of mine in AA once, and she was speaking. She goes, "Can I take you to dinner? Would you come support me while I'm speaking?" "Sure." So we went to dinner, and she said, she had been married to a guy from our home group for a number of years, and she goes, "Here's how you find your husband in AA. You look around the meeting, and you find the guy that repulses you most. That's the man." And that was my husband. That was my husband. I didn't like my husband. I didn't think much of him. I thought he was arrogant and self-centered, much like myself. And there's only room for one big head in this family. So, I didn't date for 4.5 years in AA. When my sponsor suggested I leave the poor men alone, they had had enough of me in this world, I realized that he was right. And as I started to do inventory and realized the behavior I exhibited in relationships with men, the power and the demands I put on them, it became very easy for me to stay away from them because I didn't want to continue that kind of action and behavior. But when he finally asked me out to dinner, I was ready to really see if there had been some recovery in my life. And quite frankly, I wanted the free dinner. And I said yes after a few months of telling him no. And I got very strict direction on how to go to dinner and how to act like a lady when I was dating. And we ended up getting married a year later, shortly after I left that sponsorship. And my husband and I have been married almost 10 years, or actually over 10 years now. And things started to go awry at that point. I got another sponsor in my home group. She is a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name was Karen G. from Los Angeles. And loved that woman, and she did the best she could with me. But I decided that now that I was married and now that I was trying to start a family, that it was time to scale it back a little bit, you know. Not that I was consciously doing that, you guys, but I had other people in my home group. I was trying to find those other women that started sitting in the back like I did, and all we were talking about was what type of fertility medicine we were on, you know. And I was going to try to get my education finished, so now I wasn't going to start taking commitments in institutions anymore. I ended up getting pregnant and having my son in 2003, and, well, you know, I can't go to meetings now. I got a baby. You know, I know that it didn't stop someone here tonight, God bless her, that's great. But quite frankly, I'm tired. And, you know, you can't tell me, you don't understand what it's like to have a newborn, so don't tell me what to do, was my attitude. And, things were getting dark for me, and I didn't really know it, you guys, I was moving backwards. And I moved to Arizona for a brief period of time. My husband hated Los Angeles. I whined and complained for 3 years there, so he couldn't take it anymore. He took me back to L.A. in 2006. And my husband, again, still hates L.A. and wanted to go back where there's four seasons. By golly, I ended up in Pennsylvania. My husband's from Boyertown, and he works at Merck. And here we are in Pennsylvania where it gets cold. God, it gets cold. And cold in the wintertime. And you hear fashionable coats here. I didn't realize you could get a fashionable coat. I thought I had to look like the Michelin man all the time. And that's not the way. You got to wear shoes that hold on the ice and stuff. I didn't know that either. And y'all taught me that in AA. But I came out here and I realized I needed to start getting busy in AA. Things were not going well. My husband now knew that my voice was louder than his thinking. And things were not going well. And my son, I was starting to scream at my son because he required too much of my time. I ended up adopting a child. And he took a lot of work too, and he pissed me off. God, you people make me mad. And I started going, I was at a meeting at Cedars one night, and I remember sharing. And I thought to myself after I've done, God, you are so full of shit. I'm trying to share about what I did 12 years ago, not because I'm not doing anything now. I'm showing up when I can get my husband to watch the kids, and I can sneak out of the house and get home quick. And so I went to Founders Day 2 years ago, and my former sponsor was there. And he said, come out, and why don't you start doing what we're doing again? And I started crying when I saw the people he was working with there because I saw that light in their eyes. I saw sobriety in action. I saw selflessness and participation in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked him to sponsor me again. And I'm so grateful. My life has never been better. My husband's been living overseas in London for the last year. He's working for the Navy over there as a reservist, and I'm with my kids. I'm in college full-time now trying to get that done, and because I can, you know, and I have support today. But it's the only way I keep it going is because I go to AA. You know, I go to 4 meetings a week now. I diligently work the 12 steps today, 10th and 11th, every morning and every night. I call 6 people a day in AA. I have to do a gratitude list every day. And I check in with my sponsor at 1:15, not 1:16, 1:15 every day, Monday through Friday. I go to AA workshops. I say yes when I'm asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel that hope back. I feel that energy back. I feel like I'm back where I'm supposed to be, and I feel like I'm more to the person that God was intending for me to be. And my sponsor was talking to me recently, and he said, the greatest gift you can give to your Father, God, your higher power, is to be who you are, because that's who He made you to be. And I thought, well, how am I supposed to do that? He goes, you got to work the 12 steps. You got to uncover those old ideas, as it talks about in step 2. Through that inventory work that we do to uncover what your thinking is, what your faulty ideas are, so you can bring in some new ideas that work in your life. And my life is terrific today. Just one quick story. I'm actually done almost a little early here. Couple of stories I want to tell you. First, I'll start with my son, Christian. Christian's 6.5 years old, and I adopted him formally 2 years ago, 2 years in June. He is my maternal nephew. He is my sister's son. My younger sister is one of us. I think I referenced that a little bit. And she has struggled, and she doesn't really like the program. She's afraid of people, and I understand that completely. And she had her second son, Christian, 6.5 years ago in Texas, and she did the best that she could. And I got a call in Arizona that we were looking for Christian because my sister had been spotted panhandling at a 7-Eleven, and the car seat wasn't in the car. He was nowhere to be found. We didn't know where he was. And my mother works at a hospital, and her coworker saw my sister. And so I got a call in Arizona saying you need to turn on the news in Houston. Go to the website and turn on CBS News because we found Christian. Christian was on the CBS News as the John Doe in foster care. He had been left at a hotel near the airport. And he was 10 months old. I don't hate my sister for that. You know, she's doing the best that she could. She had to go get what she had to get and do what she had to do. She's doing the best that she could. And I try to keep her. I asked for custody of Christian. It took me 1.5 years to get him. He went through multiple foster homes before he came to us. And he's having some developmental issues now. And I'm trying to work the program to be the best mom I can to him. But I'm selfish and self-centered, you guys, and sometimes it's not that easy for me. But I love him dearly, and I send pictures to her all the time, and I want her to be a part of his life as best she can be, but I don't know when she'll get the chance to see him again. I guess when things get better for her. And also, one more story. When my father died, you know, I went through that whole thing. I had this AA brother named Mike, and he sponsored a bunch of guys in Las Vegas, and then he sponsored a bunch of guys when he moved down to San Diego, and Mike and his wife were really active in AA, and I thought he and his wife were just terrific because they sponsored a bunch of people. They were contributing members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Mike was 31 years old, and She got Lou Gehrig's disease. And, stop it. Okay, so he got Lou Gehrig's disease, and he was terrified, and he went down to Mexico trying to find alternative medicine, and he was scared. He was really scared, and because he knew that was terminal. And as Mike got sicker and sicker, he was living down in San Diego. We started taking meetings to Mike in San Diego. He had a wheelchair and got a donor van and would come up to Los Angeles at 120 miles every Wednesday to come to home group when he could. And as he got increasingly sicker and became bedridden, we would drive to San Diego every Friday night and take him a meeting. And one time before he lost the ability to walk, I was playing basketball against him because my sponsor always said there's nothing funner to watch than a bunch of alcoholics trying to play team sports. And I was trying to play defense on Mike, and Mike collapsed on the basketball court and he started crying because he was afraid. He started losing his coordination, and I just was crushed. I burst into tears. I was uncontrollable, and my sponsor walked over to Mike and he said, "Get up off your ass. You need to keep playing." And my sponsor knew my story with my dad, but Mike hadn't known. He goes, "You don't know the kind of example you're going to be to other people. You have to keep showing up." And so Mike did the best he could until he couldn't talk or move anymore. And so we used to take him meetings down in San Diego until he passed away in November of 1999. And the deal with that story is that was how I made amends to my father. I went to my father's grave up in Massachusetts a couple years later and sat at his grave and made this little letter, you know, this kind of traditional way of doing things, but I realized that everything had already been made okay. And to an old-timer in my old home group, he said, "You already took care of your business." I couldn't have written that script, you guys. I could not have thought of that or created that situation all by myself. But I showed up as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to do my best to be of service, and I was greatly rewarded. And I love stories in AA where people, when they make AA the priority of their life, great things come to pass. I get to be a mother today. Sometimes I'm glad you don't get to see me do that, because I'm not always that great. But there's hope. I get to be a member here. I get to make friends here. I get to have a life. I'm not just a mom. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to have friends in AA, and I still get to do this thing, and I still get to hire babysitters and sometimes this stuff, but I get to be with you guys. I'm so grateful for that. I want to thank you for sticking with me tonight and listening to my story, and thanks again. Yeah.